bottleneck.
Yeah, bring in, yeah, but
and we're talking about in the gelatin after the gelatin side.
So we've got this Mr. Dryer, you know, it's a huge thing, it was 65 foot long.
It's made by a company named Lister, is that?
Yeah, yeah. Lister was Dursley.
Dursley.
Lost us here.
Okay.
Anyway, yeah. The first cause is because the paper makers, the old paper, are against this thing. They said, this is no good. Grandfather tried it, it wasn't any good. Grandfather never even saw it, but anyway. They said, we no good, the paper, it'll ruin the paper. So yeah, we tried this machine out, we set it up, got it going, got some couple of women there putting the paper in and taking it out, and this thing went like a crackerjack job. Dried a week, making the paper in less than 2 days. So, well, this is the end of the bottleneck. We've got, what's wrong with the paper? Paper seems alright. Anyway, the next day...
What's wrong with the paper? It seems alright, yeah.
When we came the next day, the old chap, the paper maker, old Sam Easton, obviously full of joy. That paper's no good. I found out what the trouble is, what's wrong with it. And apparently, you know, the hydraulic test of paper, don't you know, the machine. Well, this paper that is normal is, I think, 160. Don't quote me his exact figure. I think the paper was 160. And the stuff that came through the Lister driver was under 100.
So you could poke your finger right through it, theoretically?
Oh, no. Not so, 100 pound pressure.
Yeah, okay.
Like, you know,
all right.
But it was down, right down, and it wouldn't do. Panic stations. Oh, this machine's no good. The old paper maker saying, "Oh, I told you so."
Yeah, I told you so.
I have to take the kudos for this because I thought myself, well, what can the difference be? I mean, one drop right in the air and the RPM go up, and the other one was the off the machine. Why it dried quicker? I like the answer. This suddenly struck me, in the size machines, the temperature of the size never had to rise above 120 degrees Fahrenheit.
Mm-hmm.
Or it cracked the size and it was no good. Because in this machine, we were drying size paper at 180 degrees.
I thought,
this is cracking it. I'm going to wonder. So I said to the boss, who was a bit of panic or something, look, let's put it through the machine at under 120 degrees. Because this design could adjust anything you wanted on it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is never good in the law. And so we set it down to, I think, 115. Because we found then we had to score the machine down. It didn't do a week's making in under 2 days. It took nearly 3 days to do it. But when it tested the hydraulic test, the paper was perfect. It wasn't over the top.
So that really...
And it went fine, and it was useful then on.
So you got production going just perfect, and then they closed the mill.
Yeah, and then the paper went out first, and then we tried pulp in that machine, broke it up, and these big lumps of pulp were in, like, sagging, caught in each other, the trays tied themselves in knots.
So when you made pulp at the mill, you shipped it out in dry lap form, or dry sheet form?
Some of it, and some of it went in, damp. It's wrapped in plastic.
I bought it in bales.
A lot of this pulp then, in these blocks, was going away moist. They had to be down to, I think it was 20% or something like that. They had a percentage thing, but we had to get used to jabbing, But, I thought, well, if we put a wire mesh around this thing and no boxes in at all. When he took it out, could we cut it? It was guillotine in the blocks. Like. Of course, when they approached the people editors, they didn't really want it in blocks particularly. They didn't really care what it was like, as long as it was handleable. So we tried these machines, we had these, you know, put them up to speed, pour the pulp in through the big 3-inch pipe until it was up to the level. Spin it out and then break it and take it out. You've got a big bolster which you fold it over and put in a plastic bag.
Oh, so that's how you
said it. They sent it away and we're happy with that. Yeah. And that's how we did all that.
So all that hard work you did, it wasn't necessary.
them.
Stuff that went away dry called flock?
Flock, yeah.
Mm.
And what we did was actually the local firm at Newton Abbott made machinery for making cider. And they had a gadget in there, you put the apples in, and they go through, you got to mash the apples off mm-hmm. before you press them. They got this thing like a series of bars spinning around your housing, you know, and it's smashed the apples to pieces and shot them out and everything. So I went, get one of these and I got them to try it. And we found that they shot more bolsters in them slowly and it came out pretty well perfect clock. Actually, it was inclined to be an occasional lump. So what we did was we got two of these machines and put it through one, through the other, and when it came out at the end, it was just ready for drying, you know. And,
oh, that's great.
And then we used a vacuum blower. Well, these things actually blew it up to the first place, but dropped on a conveyor into another dryer that we got over. But we used to dry it by blowing the air through it.
You had a lot of equipment around.
And then at the end of that, it came out into a chute, where a vacuum picked it up and took it into the packing room, where the pipe that came to the vacuum fan had a Shirley wheel to it. Have you ever heard of a Shirley wheel?
No.
Well, it's a... You imagine a pipe with a slot in it.
Yeah.
And you put a wheel made of mesh
mm-hmm.
in it. You suck your pulp along and turn your wheel. The wheel takes all the pulp out and the air goes on, like, you know, and then put the pulp drops into the press underneath.
Huh.
And when the press reaches out a certain height, you press that knot and put the bands on it and you've got a bale of flop to go away like that.
Put the bands around it. Huh.
That's really why we put these metal bands around.
That's pretty amazing.
That was flop, that wasn't paper. How do you process your, like, your bands there?
The what?
Parlance, the way you talk.
Oh, the way you talk?
Yeah, it's half stuff, it's the pulp that has been broken and bleached and has come back to be beaten.
Yeah.
That's half stuff, like that. It hasn't been beaten.
Right, so that's what I...
You're the same way.
It is.
Yeah, yeah.
And flock would it be the same except for dry?
Well, the flock would be half stuff, but it is... Well, half stuff is wet and... the bleach hasn't even been taken out of it. The flock would be pure, rather long, I think you'd call it pulp, but long, it's long, it would have to be beaten again, but it was always pure white, or sometimes it was coloured,
I see. We get...
That used to make me laugh, because it was always, put of us, N-O-T.
And what is that written on? On the ream wrapper, you mean, or...?
If you get adverts for it, you know, this is N-O-T, not hot pressed.
Not hot pressed, and O-T means?
Presumably hot pressed.
Yeah, but where's the O come from?
Well, hot without the H. Hot. Hot. Local parlance again. Yeah.
It's a paper maker spelling, right?
Yeah. Mind you, I used to pull the leg an awful lot about their spelling and that and how they knew their trade. Because when they started on a scheme where there was a clock, where they had a clock in and out when they broke down, they used to have to put on there what the breakdown was. And they could never spell it. I mean, they used to spell Deco, D-E-K-K-O. And... there's a lot of little words I used to pull a leg of it and say, you know, even a lot of letters in paper makers are supposed to be educated.
Right.
I used to come by the river.
Can we're talking here about on page 4, which I was trying to figure out where the stuff came in, and she was saying that the boats, the boats, everything, rags came in by...
Yeah, rags.
And then it says halfway between the... I'll write this down, this is ridiculous. What I was trying to figure out is where would the estate, what's the difference between the estates and the terraces? So the estate people and the terrace people, was there a difference or is that something I made up?
Ah, you meant the Sharpton estate at Ashburton.
Is that what it's called? Sharp? S-H-A-R?
Sharp.
S-H-
Sharpham.
Oh, Sharpham, Sharpham Estate.
Yes.
And what was the Sharpham Estate?
That was a private estate owned by the local squire who owned the village of Ashton. And it took, well, a generation really, for them to really mix with the papermakers and the estate people to really mix.
How many people lived in the estate? Lots or just a few? A couple families?
Oh, no, there was,
all of them?
You see, they had big families, didn't they? There was 10 houses around the gardens.
About 30 houses. Yeah. Oh, so it was a lot of people.
Yeah, it was quite a village.
The squire put, the local squire built this whole estate to house relatives in, or?
Work people.
Oh.
Basically, work people.
And what did they work on, his farms? Is that?
Yes, he had, the estate had about 5 farms. Then there was 3 or 4 big woods. There was woodsmen, there was gamekeepers, there was farm labourers working on the farm.
What do woodsmen do? Cut wood? Is that?
Oh, look after the woods.
Sure.
Plant new trees, cut the wood for the old... I mean, they burnt wood in the big house.
Right, so somebody had to get that.
Yeah. They had about 3 woodsmen. Get a gamekeeper, an under-gamekeeper, and the women worked in the house, housemaids. They had a butler. They had about 5 gardeners.
And the house had 52 windows and 365 panes. That was the world of gardeners.
And they never sort of mixed. I mean,
not really,
the local women couldn't quite approve of the papermakers' wives who came down, and they'd go to the public house, you see, and the local women never went near a public house.
Now, local women mean the estate people?
Yeah, they never went to the public. They went to church on Sunday and worked all the week.
So were the estate people, had they been there longer than the papermakers?
Yeah.
Longer than, say, the Eden family?
Yeah. They'd all been,
generations and generations.
Mix now.
Interesting.
When did he? They built Sharpham. He, the man who. I'm talking about the original builder. He built Sharpham with prize money from one of the naval sort of.
What century?
About 1700 or something like that.
I see.
Mm-hmm. The estate, he bought the estate and built the house.
This history.
Okay.
But the estate people were very sort of, how do you put it, introvert.
Okay, now the terrace people, what's that mean?
The Tuckerley people lived in the, terrace, the papermakers, and all this.
The terrace, why do they call it the terrace? Just because the houses are
in a terrace.
On the hillside?
No, a long terrace of houses.
One long row of houses.
Yeah, and this
was down in the middle.
Yeah.
And there were, are they below?
Workmans.
Are they below the bungalow where Cyril and George live now?
Yeah, terrace along there. But that was, and the papermakers, they had concerts. They'd been to London, they went to the pub.
So they were much more socialized people, huh?
Yeah. And they didn't
see more of the world?
They didn't mix, really, until, how do I put it, father-in-law married.
Somebody got married, right?
Mother-in-law, you know, the young people intermarried, and then the two communities really mixed. Apart from that, they only sort of mixed at church, because the church people went to church.
So this note says basically that they started mixing when the clubhouse was built, because they'd come to the concerts there some.
Well, they would occasionally, but not a lot. Hmm. They didn't really. How did it?
The clubhouse basically belonged to the mill. Right?
Yeah. But when the parish hall, when they built the parish hall, which is now gone, then they started to mix. The people from the estate started going, the younger people going to dances and things there. That's when it started to really gel in the, let's say, 20s.
Yeah.
Late 20s.
So you were pretty young then.
Yeah, yeah.
And then after that, before the war, was pretty much everybody pretty mixed up? I mean pretty social,
yeah,
socially,
yeah,
together by that,
yeah,
time?
Yeah, yeah. You see, the daughter of the squire ran the girl guide.
Ran the, say that again?
The girl guides, you know.
No, I don't know what girl guides are.
Boy Scouts?
Oh, Boy Scouts, okay.
Guides.
Yeah,
yeah,
I know what you mean, girl guides.
Okay. Baden Powell, you know, started the Boy Scouts.
Okay, got it now.
Yeah. Well, she ran the local. And so she pulled in the children from the papermaker's children and the estate children, all mixed.
I see.
And this sort of had a great mixing thing as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And probably the war effort sort of brought everybody together in,
yeah,
a way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, of course, then the estate was sold.
Oh, so it was...
He died, the old squire. His nephew... had no son, so it was the end.
And so did all the people buy their own houses, or did they all have to move out?
No, they could. They were offered the houses for about £100 each and things like this. Ridiculously low.
Did a lot of the people buy their houses?
And most of them did.
But how did that change the nature of the estate? I mean, you say...
The estate was sold, the farms were sold off.
Oh, so they didn't have any work. I mean, not the same sort of work.
No.
Is that why it changed? Because they weren't all working for the same guys?
That's right, yes.
Did they have quite a social... So there was two terraces. There was,
yeah,
the official terrace, which is right below the bungalow,
yeah,
and there's,
yeah,
another...
Yeah, that was Orchard Terrace, and
mm-hmm.
then there's Bridge Terrace, the other side, where that had five papermakers living there, didn't it? Which belonged to the local farmer.
The terrace did.
Yeah, the other terrace did. They were rented by the... And then the odd houses in the rest of the village were the local farms.
Yeah. Yeah.
You worked right up till they closed the,
yeah,
receivership.
In fact, I stayed on for about a year breaking up the machinery and that before.
You worked for the receivers for a couple of years, didn't you?
Oh my God, I put that money on the washer.
And oh gosh. Right before it closed, who was working there? Was Cyril was working there, or who,
yeah,
he left then?
Oh, yes. There was 80 working there when it closed.
There was 80 people working there when it closed. Oh, so there was women, there was all the women that worked in the rag department.
Yeah, they were still working.
But they just didn't need the finishers, that's all. But
no, the paper end was gone, but,
yeah. The paper room was expanded from one large breaker beater and six small ones to 14 large ones. That's the six small ones, I get
them. Sure. You just had a lot of equipment moving around, didn't you? That must have been an immense expense. So the boilers were for boiling the rags in, right? And it would get big lumps.
No,
no,
this was general steam to boil the rags.
Oh.
This was a big Lancashire boiler.
This is page 10. Yeah.
That generated steam at about 100 pounds per square inch. I used to feed this. There were four rag boilers. They were heated by steam injection.
Now, who would do this kind of work?
The labourers.
The labourers on the beater boilers to fill the fill.
So labourers weren't really... They weren't... Were they part of the paper making... I mean, were they part of the mill staff?
Well, yeah.
The rag boiling business, when they're making paper, there was only one rag boiler then. They only used that about once a week, and they used to boil such a lot of rag.
Before you started making pulp, did you ever buy pulp already made, or did you make all your pulp?
By winter or something.
Mm-hmm.
That was only for the cheaper paper.
Right, but so you didn't, produce the volume of pulp, so you didn't need all the boiling.
No,
oh, okay.
No. I mean, 3 tons of paper in a week or 2 weeks or something, they're making paper.
3 tons is a lot.
Well,
but
it is, but not if you've got a mill behind you, like, you know. I mean, we're talking about 120 tons of pulp.
Okay, so anyway, before in those boilers you had to chip off the lime, and then it says then you treat it, later you chemically treat it with something. I couldn't figure out what the word was.
Oh,
let me stop.
Boiler with hammers going, you know, bang, bang, bang.
Did anyone in your family have to do that sort of work, or friends of yours when you were a kid?
Dad used to do it at one time, but as he got older, he didn't.
Do you remember when the kids you'd play with it when you were you were working in the mill? Would they talk about how bad the jobs they had to do were?
No, I don't think so. The shop was always the food was because there was no baths or anything, because there was no hot water, so they all came home black. I mean, normally. If anybody got dirty, there was hot water so they could go into a tub and have a bath, but not when the shut was, when they really needed it. There was no hot water.
The shut means when everything's shut down to do all the cleaning.
Yeah, that's right.
How often would that happen?
Every August.
Fortnight, a little over the other way.
So that means 12 or 2 weeks?
Yes, in August.
That was on holiday.
They'd have
the
2 weeks holiday.
And you should stay and do this.
They had their holiday later.
I see.
Not all in a bunch, like, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But
all the women and the paper makers and that all had their
holiday. Okay. Thinking about it, when I started there, they only had a week's holiday. So that the paper makers had a week's holiday, and then the second week of the shut fortnight, they used to come and help. Because they used to be very annoyed because they just keep dirty jobs for them just to
So they say you save all the dirty ones.
You know, show them as soon as the gas in and tip the carbon out and things like that.
Say that again, I didn't understand it.
Stick them up the cylinder of the gas engine.
Oh, stick them up the cylinder of a gas engine. I'm getting smarter. Go ahead.
Whitewashing jobs, you know.
Painting all the buildings and
yeah,
stuff?
Yeah, you know, but it was lime wash.
Uh-huh.
Not emulsion paint in the...
And so lime wash smells bad when you're doing it, is that...?
Well, if you get a splash in your eye or something, you know, lime hurts.
Yeah, it burns.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, so that's what they gave them to do.
You're just saying that again, it's just that Harrison seemed to only sell perfect paper and...
Yeah.
So this is on page 12 where we're talking about, is there a bad Biederman? Well, you only had, who are the Biedermen when you're thinking about, like?
Well, Johnny Stevens, he came in.
We'll leave names out, I mean, it doesn't really matter. So you had how many Biedermen, you think?
I think it was two, but then the third one
would
come in, but they said
it
was labor
to
help.
Oh, they always had a labor to help. Well, after all, they had to go up to the end of the mill leak, up to the mill pond, to turn on the water. Though the Biedermen didn't really want to do that, but they had to have somebody go up and turn on the water to...
Open the gate?
Yeah, they had to open the gate.
This is because, of course, they were the biggest user of power, and therefore they controlled the power, which was basically a water turbine.
Right.
But the gas engine was the thing, but if it was enough water, they used to cut the turbine out, and then they had to completely control it by there. But they used to love to keep the gas engine in, because if the turbine ran away, the gas engine would all die, and then it would control it without them bothering too much. But if they were running on water, the Biederman had to watch his gear speed, didn't go too high or too low, and if it did, he had to turn a few notches off on the turbine, which would flood the leak from the top if it didn't shut off.
It would flood the lake.
Drain it if it didn't open up, actually.
And was that manually done?
Yeah.
Big screw.
So they'd send the labourer up to do
that? Right. Yeah.
They'd go up and put two screws on, you
know. Did they ever flood?
You've taken it off, you'd be put four on.
You've taken it off?
Taking it off and set putting it on, like it.
Oh.
Lowered the gate and set it on. Yeah, like that.
So that's one place where the Bieder people caused trouble.
Yeah.
But so would one person always, their batches of pulp always come out better than somebody else's?
Well, one of the paper makers of a pal of mine, Jimmy Inks, said he was interested in radio and that same job at the time.
Jimmy?
Inks, he was called.
H-I-N-K-S-P-O-N?
He was a Batman.
And he was interested in radio, too?
Yeah, and so we used to do hobnob it, but we used to say...
Used to hobnob?
That's the word. I knew that during that last beer full of pulp. Who's that? That was Lencox.
I know who made it.
How do you know?
Yeah, go ahead.
The way your paper makes
Really, so they could sort of know. So some people did make better batches consistently than others.
Yeah, they used to know the difference.
It's only hearsay in my case, but Sam was always considered to be the good man above the other two. If Sam was on, he wouldn't let anything down that was they'd come along and say, come on, we're waiting. But Sam would say, well, it's not ready.
Uh-huh.
They couldn't hustle Sam into letting something down that wasn't quite right.
Now, why would the papermakers, the VAT people, want their paper sooner, or the pulp sooner?
They wouldn't. It would be the foreman.
Oh.
They would be quite happy to sit and wait.
I was thinking that might be the case.
Yes, it would be the foreman or the manager or whatever he called himself who would be hustling, not the Batman.
Jimmy Inks would always say, you know, if Sam lets it down, no trouble at all. Like, you know, if Len lets it down, he'll watch it. Sometimes a good one, sometimes a bad one.
Sometimes it's a good one, sometimes it's a bad one.
Yeah.
Well, I'm working right along. We'll find it out. What else? Remember, did he complain about or talk about anything else? Any other good stories that he told you that you remember?
Yeah, well, they'll come out.
For quite a while with Cyril. He was one of Cyril's...
In his team?
Yeah.
What do you call the team? I mean, because I guess one different people... Different set of Batman, Kutcher, and Lair work together, right?
You just call them Bat.
One Bat.
By the number. You know.
So, like...
Number three Bat.
Number three.
And so Cyril and Jimmy and somebody else were number something?
Number three were on that.
And who was the other person in their Bat crew?
I think it was Ron.
Was Ron?
No, because he was Bat.
No, it was Ayersy, wasn't it? So... Jimmy and
Ayersy
was number
three. How do you say
Ayersy? That was his surname. I can't think what his Christian name was.
Is this what you call it?
A-Y-R-S-I, I think it was like that,
Ayersy. A-Y-R-S-E.
Something like
that. Yeah. Anyway, so they were a team, and then they have an end bullet sometimes? Would they need the boy?
They don't have a boy with them very often, but the boys who have to go around, if they were making a small sheet, they didn't consider they needed a boy. Because he was supposed to help the layer pick the large sheet up, but then he would help. And, usually the boy wouldn't make
it. Kutcher, wasn't it?
Yeah, Kutcher, sorry. But then, if they were making a large sheet, they considered they needed a boy to help because they
felt in strong. Flip the felt.
Yeah, and do you remember any of your friends that worked with those kind of boys? In boys? So nobody you really knew got. Who got that
nobody
kind of job?
When the apprentices started. With this sort of job.
Right, so I guess some of your friends must have been doing that job.
To start with, they mostly all did, I think. This was the point. They came in, you know, the first year or so of their apprenticeship, and they did all the odd jobs, like...
In later years, you got a couple of kids from Dr. Bernardo,
A couple of kids from where?
Dr. Bernardo's home. That's
the orphan kids?
That's right, yeah. Everyone started being the boy. They had to clean up when the Batman finished, clean up the
So they had the rotten job of the whole thing, didn't they?
Always the lads that started, yes, they had to clean up. See if the knotter, if the knotter was, clagged up, with the threads and that, they were expected to pick it. If it wasn't
bad enough to go out to be done properly.
Yeah, we have a big load of folks.
The lads who stepped away.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of witch doctoring up there. That we, the knotters, I mean, I don't know what a knotter is, I don't know
yeah.
what they are, but each of that, they've got two knotters. And they use one for fine papers and one for coarse papers. Okay? This is to be the story one. I looked at it and I thought, I don't know. I measured them with a field gauge.
But you looked at what?
I looked at the knotters.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And measured the slot with a field gauge.
Yeah.
And only a little bit of wear in places, they were all 15 thousandths of an inch.
Right.
So I, you know, said, well, what's the difference between knotters? Oh, one's finer than the others. Said they're not, they're all 15 thousandths. Oh, no, they're finer. You've got these tools on. You're not accurate enough measurement for paper bag. You know, it's not obviously not accurate enough. You can measure a thousandth of an inch, you're way over your paper. Anyway, yeah. And then closer examination, I found stamped in the side of these knotters, cut number 3. And they were all cut number 3.
And so they were doing using different knotters for different jobs, but they were all
just
the same?
Pure hell of it. The point was, it was another racket, you see, they just finished cleaning up, ready to go. The knotters got to be changed. Well, I used to have to recruit the stoker to come in with me to change these numbers.
So you had to get the stoker to help you lift them?
Yeah, they weighed about 4.5 hundred weight, these
bronze. How much is 100 weight?
112 pounds.
Okay, they're pretty heavy.
Well, they're, you know, bronze things, and probably 6 foot plus 3 foot high, 9 inches deep, and the plates are, you know, nearly two inches thick. They got these 960 slots in them. But, you know, you should take a bit of wine, you just have to sort of walk them out over whatever, and then get another one back in, and then you should have to balance them, as they call it, get them to go like that instead of like this.
Yeah.
And
get a balance.
And then it used to go again, like, you know, they go.
And they get.
And they'd be sitting down watching, and they wouldn't help. They would go, oh no, to the paper maker's job, they helped with doing that. Then after the big row, like, oh, what's the name, they had to change them for themselves. And they changed them out of that.
It isn't a paper maker's job to help with a bloody knotter, yeah? So,
you're not supposed to say
that. Really? So, tell me the story again, because I want to make the one you told just right before that. Because the recorder wasn't going, I don't think. So, they used to call you. Just tell me the story.
What? The knotter.
Right.
Which consists of sticking a thin blade through each slot. 960 or
right.
And, you know, I didn't like it a lot, but it wasn't much fun. And they'd be sitting there watching, you know, there's four or five blokes sitting watching you while you do this little job. Oh, there was one other thing to that as well, add to that. The spindle that came through the back that drove the hog, agitator in the bottom, someone in the dim, dark past ordained that a piece of felt had to be wrapped around that filter and tied with paper maker's tape.
No, wait, that's somebody that had a piece of felt wrapped around what?
Around the spindle.
Okay, around the spindle.
Where it came out of the back, it'll come out to a fork.
And what's paper maker's tape?
It was a linen tape that they used to tie the paper up with. It was flat tape. But then this had to be bound with a linen tape and tied on. This was supposed to stop the spindle going around forming knots for the paper. It's just a story.
Inside the vat.
Inside the vat, you know, it's under the water. But only the engineer was allowed to do this flipping job. Like, I'd be up the mill pond doing something to the paint, and a boy comes trotting up and says, so-and-so want the spindle wrap. Like, you go in there, four or five blokes sitting there, and they've been waiting half an hour for me to come in and wrap it up. So that came in too. They had to do their own spindle, their own picking, and change their own knotters. I didn't like it a lot, but they did it. I don't think it did. I think the bit of tape on the spindle didn't get put on anymore. You know? Never got any knots in the pick. Well, they might have got one or two, but they always did anyway. Because I can see a piece of tape and felt rubbing right now, they're less liable to make a knot than a plain joint.
I can see them just sending that little boy up to get you while they're sitting around.
I could be, I mean, once I was up at the chimney, which is up top of the hill.
Mm-hmm.
Doing a manhole cover up there.
Doing what?
Manhole cover.
Oh, okay.
It was leaking. We went up.
Oh, you're fixing the manhole cover.
Cement up and covering up here, and the boy comes up, you know. Number three, that was his
So yeah. Was one bat worse than the other? Was number somebody always calling you more than?
No, I think actually I said number three then. And probably that was the one that called me least, actually.
Yeah. Was there some of the guys that were just sort of everybody knew were lazier than other guys?
Really cut it, yeah. Jack Perrin, for instance.
Yeah?
He was a...
Anytime something he could call somebody in to clean out the knotter, he would.
He used to say, break his mould, you know, make it ragged, and cut his finger on it, and come in, look what your mould's done to me. That's a big mould. My mould is yours, you big fat so-and-so.
The mould is yours, you big fat so-and-so.
Yeah. Well, I've been, one of these, for instance, is like at the end of a shot, I guess, started up, you know.
The end of a what?
End of the shot.
At the end of the shot, right, okay.
The most on them was over the back house, they all cleaned the back up, they got everything ready, and waiting, and down comes the Pope, and they send a boy to look for me, because none of their spindles are there. There's 14 of them.
None of their spindles have been taken, they're all waiting, watching you, right?
And this particular town, I come in and said, you know, lousy, lazy lot of so-and-so, it's in all of you. If you don't like it, you'll see what you can do about it. And one of them got up, you know. I thought, so you want to fight about that? No.
You want to fight about it? No. So they just sat around, huh?
Yeah. I mean, I think they actually killed their own trade in the end, because, you know, they just...
That's what you said here, and I thought that was pretty interesting, yeah.
Yeah.
Pearl, do you remember any of those traveling papermakers coming to stay in Tuckanay, or do you?
Yeah, I can remember,
I don't think there's any after.
Well,
no, when you were children.
The Netherlands, they had no children, and they had a spare room, and they used to occasionally stay with the Netherlands, I can remember. They didn't seem to stay there. It was, what do they call them, when they finished their time somewhere else.
If they couldn't absorb them, they had to go off, didn't they?
What did they call them?
The Cardiff.
Or I don't know what the name, I've forgotten what the...
They got the name of Journeyman in the end.
It was...
You think it's Journeyman because they travelled around, huh?
Yeah, I think they come and do that. 6 months or somewhere, and then move on to another mill to get the different experience.
I think it was improvers.
Improvers, I think they called them.
Improvers when they were wandering around, because they sort of get experience in all the different mills, learn some things from here and there.
Yes, I think so. But I'm sure it was after they'd done their apprenticeship at one mill, you know, they sort of moved on.
I've got no idea that is, you know, thinking about it.
Nelson Wiedlin.
Well, he was a batman in the middle of the day. He was a long time. I'm not sure he didn't die before the war, didn't he? Or during the war.
So did he was he's some traveling man that came and sort of stayed?
No, he was there. I mean, I as far as I know, he was there, with, you know, he was a permanent member of the mill, but
mm-hmm.
I was, you know, of course I lived in the pub, the war on his arm, they always used to come along there, and Nelson used to come along here. He used to sing the song, I don't want no pictures on the wall, give me the value in the mug. the older paper makers, don't seem to be a real drinking gang, like, you know, heavy drinkers. Nelson Wiedlin, and Frank Davis.
Sid Smith. Once a week, Sidney was.
Yeah, but he used to...
What's that, once a week?
Yeah.
Drunk, you mean?
Yeah.
He used to go to put his feet in, and he used to take them right up to his neck.
And his, wait, put his feet in what?
His beer, I think. He used to get real, you know.
But he was,
his story was that he wanted to dampen his feet.
Wait, what's the story?
His story was that he only wanted to dampen his feet in the beer.
Oh, in the beer?
Beer.
Oh, in the beer?
At the pub.
Okay.
Just a little drop he was putting out. But it used to come up around his neck, and he couldn't walk home.
Oh, so that's how he'd say he'd drink it. He said, I just wanted to get a little feel down my feet.
That's okay. There was a lovely and it was man, he used to always get singing drunk.
Who was the ice-winking bloke?
He used to always, by the end of the evening, have a sing-song.
Oh, he was always singing, not singing.
He was never a fighting man, he was a...
That's nice.
A singing man, he was always lovely company, if he was drunk, he was never obnoxious, he was lovely.
Who was the ice-winking bloke with just such a way on his...
May.
May, that's right, Bob May, he was another one, wasn't he? My old grandmother used to live at Ashwinton, used to come down and spend a lot of her time down at the Waterman's Arms. Used to walk up with her at evening when she went home, and she'd say, just a minute, I'll see if Bob's all right, and he'd go over the edge, and he'd be sound asleep over the edge.
She knows that behind the hedge.
She could never go by, like, making sure he was all right.
Billy Boyce and his wife a managing lady, and he was given sixpence to go out with, to have a drink and to buy his tobacco, like, you know, sixpence even in those days, he didn't buy an awful lot of beer and baccy for that.
He was his father's son, Calvin, his old Billy, Boyce, he was called, he had to saw a stick or something, he's going to go on the fire.
We don't understand that at all.
Saw a log, you know,
okay,
for the fire, and his wife was a good saw, but the only one. He had this saw, and it used to take him all day, nearly all Sunday, to saw through this log. So I said to my father one day, "Wish you'd sharpen my saw for me. Well, bring him down, I'll sharpen it." My father, a bit of a handyman, brought this saw down, and I'd never seen a saw like it.
To me about Walter Godwin was he said that he rents the felts from the vat. What job did he do?
Great.
Does that make any sense? I know what I missed, Pearl, was you were telling me how they liked rinsing the felts because...
They washed the felts after they finished their day's work. They packed an hour, packed less, packed more, but they were paid piecework. So... this was extra to their wages, and they were quite happy to do this because money was short, and this was sort of an extra perk, the felt wash.
No, Fred Lynn was in charge?
Fred Lynn,
and
one of these.
So would he choose who got to do it?
Oh, no.
Did they rotate the job?
Well,
Fred Lynn was more or less in charge of the felt washing. See, they pulled in what wanted washing and what didn't want washing, all that sort of thing. And then he nearly recruited his, you know, sort of, anybody for felt washing. And me.
I see. And would boys be able to do it, or was it only men's job, or?
Basically.
Any apprentices?
Men, because it was
the
rich in it, you know. They could reach out and flash them down on this.
Hard work. I don't think the boys would.
Is felt rinsing different than felt washing? Are they two different jobs, or are they the same?
Well, I would say different, because when they wash them, they used to put them in hot water with ammonia and wash them, and then they rinse them out. Actually, it's part of the same job, really, because they come out and wash into the rinsing bay, and it stands over this water running and...
What's that, the what stand?
A wash stand, yeah.
Oh, a wash stand.
It's like a... tough to get out of it. It's like a trough, you know, it's so wide.
Yeah.
Made of concrete, and the water comes in the end and runs sort of between your legs and away, so you can do this with a felt, you know, and rinse it and then pass it on by yonder.
So would they just rinse felts after a day's work, or would they... and wash them every once in a while, or would they wash and rinse them at the same time?
They wash and rinse at the same time, but it's sometimes a poultry pellet will go 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
I think it go sometimes 3 days.
Yeah.
Just depends on what sort of pail they decide whether they want it washing or not, and tell the friend in and he would arrange to get a wash. But, you know.
So is it possible that they go all 3 days without being washed if they were making the same sort? And at the end of those 3 days?
Sometimes
they get some
sticky, it was
with extra little fibers all around.
And
so then they'd be washed and rinsed, or would they just rinse them sometimes, do you know?
I think they would
always
wash.
Yeah. They used to, they had this big tub that they boiled in steam injection to heat it up with ammonia, very often fed would go up and everything else in the washing tub before knocking off time.
Would they do only one size at a time in the washer? How big was it? Or would they have to sort the felts out by size after they were done?
They'd only do one at a time. And then rinse them and...
one pulse at a time, basically.
And the... Because then they'll throw them up on there, and then they put on a truck, take them down and press them, and take them back to the barracks and press them, and put them to where they're ready for the next morning, I think.
I remember Cyril saying they always would ask for new felts, but they wouldn't always get them when they wanted them. Now, how come they'd always... What's that?
Well, when the felts got worn, they should replace them, or throw them in, they never should replace a complete hunter, rarely to hold.
Could they make paper faster with newer felts or something? Or why would they want new felts?
They said they handled better.
Yeah, when it got old, it got a bit felted.
Yeah.
You know, the felt was felted, and they were difficult to...
Harder to pitch?
Yeah. A new felt was soft and...
Really
supple when they got felted is the answer.
I see. So they'd want it because they could work faster, but the guy wouldn't want to.